Yeah, so Camp David obviously is the peace treaty with Israel, with Sadat appearing in the Knesset and other such moments that etched themselves into other memories than celluloid. I think maybe we didn't want to focus on the biographies of these three leaders that you've titled the trilogy after, but I think it would be good to maybe just briefly explain where Sadat came from, why it was him that took over after Nasser died in 1970 from heart failure.
It was actually quite ironic because Sadat was the least likely person to become the president. He was he became the vice president a year before Nasser died. He was leaving to a summit in Casablanca and named him as vice president. But when Nasser died, I mean, he was the least visible member of the Revolutionary Command Council. And so there was the person who was like Nasser's right-hand man, who was seen to be the coming leader, was a chap called Ali Sabri. And in the moment after the death, while the remnants of the Revolutionary Command Council were trying to decide who would become, amongst themselves, the next president, while they left Sadat as the caretaker, he basically did a palace coup and did something called the corrective revolution and completely wiped out the Nasser hierarchy and put them all in prison, which the guy who you see, Mohammed Faye, was one of them. And it's actually quite interesting because same for Mubarak. Mubarak was the vice president for a long time, but nobody really expected him to become the real president once the time came. At the time, there was also the minister of defense of the time was General Abu Ghazala, who was extremely powerful. So in many ways, the leader or the person who becomes the Ra'is or the Zaim, the leader of Egypt, since Nasser, has not been the person expected to become so. One of the things I said earlier about,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, perhaps as we are like closing with the Sadat clips, right? Perhaps you should just go back one more time to what happened to this infrastructure of Islamism that Sadat actually put in place and then later actually fell prey to it in a way, no?
Yeah. I think we're talking, I think keeping track of when things were happening is really important, because in the 70s, in the early 70s, that's pre-Iranian revolution, Islamism as such wasn't seen as a threat, wasn't regarded as even, it was just a social movement, if you want, and a social movement that did have a grassroots, quite an extensive grassroots in the society. So when Sadat opted for that as his constituency, as his power base, I don't think he really suspected things to get out of hand, because we're talking 72, 73. But then two things happened, I think, that completely shifted this decision of his, and I think it still pursues us today. First of all was the change in Iran, and secondly was the invasion of Afghanistan. and the invasion of Afghanistan, the whole discourse of fighting the atheists, the Soviet invaders, came under the banner of Islam fighting the Soviets. So it really gave the whole. That's why I started in the first section, the radicalization of the Brotherhood. I wanted to separate these two, the militant part from your normal traditional Brotherhood. This wing of radical Islam had already appeared in society since the 60s, but they were kept under wraps. But once the whole support of the Mujahideen became almost national security, not just for Egypt, by the way, for the Americans too. It was the big banner. That was very PC to be helping the Mujahideen at the time. And it sort of opened, took the lid off the radical wing of that movement.
But he must have known, I mean, just to understand that particular contradiction, let's say, perhaps in his, he must have known that he would not get popular support from the Brotherhood base, and especially, of course, not of the more radicalized part for his Israel policies, right?
Well, I mean, the two things. First of all, Sadat was known to be quite pious. He had a zibiba. I don't know how to. It's the mark of prayer. So distinguishing himself quite radically from Nasser, who was very secular, he, as a person, was quite devout. He even coined the phrase "the pious president." And now, in terms of not getting support for Israel, ironically, when Sadat went to Jerusalem and the entire nation was up in arms because he went to pray at the Aqsa Mosque, which was still under occupation, and that's a big no-no. The only people whose voice we did not hear was the Brotherhood. They didn't clearly come out to say anything about it. So the political alliance actually made them not say anything.
Any question?
I would like if you can go back still to the place of US in this relation also to Camp David and Israel. More to even more contextualize, because this was the US and other forces was really an important moment, I mean, in these histories that you are developing. What is, how you see and how it's this capture maybe in the films, in the sections?
I actually made a very personal decision to look at the Egyptian history through an Egyptian prism rather than through the American prism. It becomes inevitable during the Mubarak reign, which you'll see, there's a whole American section. But during the Sadat period, just to answer it in a different way, Sadat wanted an alliance with the Americans. He was very clear. Sadat was very shrewd. And he saw it coming. He saw the collapse of the Soviet Union coming way before anybody else. And so he was determined to go for an alliance with America because he believed that the development of Egypt and for Egypt to become a powerful state, it needed to be within the right alliance. And so this shift to the capitalist mode, without really any infrastructure of capitalism being laid, Okay, so as much as Nasser had laid the infrastructure of socialism, he built factories, there was a lot of the infrastructure that was put in place. What happened under the Sadat regime is that one bright morning, it was an open door policies, regulations changed, and there was an inundation. The population as such could not deal with it. So you had this huge gap between rich and poor that was multiplied, like every year multiplied. Now the Americans, obviously, their promises. One thing I discovered, again, it's really interesting how one thinks things until you see a piece of paper that says the opposite. I thought that American aid was tied to the peace treaty. There isn't a single point of American aid tied to the peace treaty. The peace treaty was one thing. The whole discussion of the aid and the impact of it, because that was the main American impact on Egypt, really, came a few months later with a white paper that was negotiated with the army. It was not negotiated with Sadat. So the whole mechanism of aid came through the army, not through Sadat himself.
Maybe can you say a few words about the nature of that aid?
Okay, there are two kinds of aid. It's really complicated, but I'll try to make it simple. There are two kinds of aid. There's economic aid and there's military aid. Egypt is the second beneficiary of American aid in the world, coming after Israel. It gets $3.1 billion in total aid, out of which $200 million are economic aid. The $200 million go to civilian institutions and the rest goes to the army. Practically very little of it comes in actual money. 80 to 90%, that money is earmarked for weapons, so the money never actually leaves the United States.
Okay. Time-wise, I think we have to move to the Mubarak, so maybe you can briefly outline
So as much as I was trying to make sense of all of this, the vision and the development, the vision for the country of Nasser was clearly socialism and the infrastructure to develop based on the socialist mode. And for Sadat, it was clearly capitalism. One thing I just need to say more about this capitalism. What Sadat had in mind was a triangle: Egyptian labor, Arab money, and American technology. That triangle together, he believed, would lead to the prosperity of Egypt. And so that was his capitalist vision. And when I got to this Mubarak point, I was like, what was his vision? So, I mean, I kept trying to actually find what his vision was. It seemed ridiculous of me to say that he didn't have a vision, because he did. And his vision was based on stability. Stability, it was his key word. As much as I think Mubarak came to power under a hail of bullets. He arrived in power with the guy sitting right next to him shot to death. So I think he downsized his idea of what should happen in Egypt. And he honestly believed that stability was the key word. No grand gestures, don't rock the boat. And in that process, his first 10 years was actually all about that. And in these first 10 years, he did actually democratize Egypt. So what I've done is that I've divided it again into three sections. And the first is I'm taking over from this idea of the alliance of power and money from Sadat, because as much as his stability policy was anchored in this, it was anchored in this alliance. So the first section is about the new elite. The second section is post the Gulf War and the fear of terrorism and how security in a different form takes over the heart of the state. And the third section, and ultimately his downfall, is about succession.